This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740.
Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio, AM 740.
And welcome to the Audio Imaginarium. Before we get started, I want to welcome two new affiliates to the Conspiracy Show Network, KFEQAM in St. Joseph, Missouri.
Loose lips sink ships.
Or as my Uncle North used to say, Missouri. KFEQAM St. Joseph, Missouri, and WFEBAM in Birmingham, Alabama. Great to have you aboard, and thanks for making The Conspiracy Show part of your programming schedule. And once again, thanks to Chris Whitting and his team at Syndication Networks in Chicago for all their hard work and perseverance. It's not easy, I have to tell you, not easy placing a program like this on the air. So a lot of hard work involved. And, of course, thanks to Moses Neimer here at our flagship station, AM 740, Zoomer Radio in Toronto, for your continued support. So much going on and so little time to share. I've said this a number of times. I need at least a four-hour show, but it is what it is. Someone sent me this story from a website, although it's circulating on a number of sites, but the link was sent to me. The website is unveilingsharia.com. Now, this particular story has nothing to do with radical Islam, but it has to do with a spate of deaths within a 24-hour period. Three mainstream American network journalists, all dead within a 24-hour period earlier in the week. Ned Colt of NBC, apparently dropped dead of a stroke. He was supposedly kidnapped during the Iraq War for several days and then freed. Now, the supposedly, those are in quotes. They're not my quotes. Bob Simon, of course, you probably heard about this, of CBS, formerly of 60 Minutes, died in a car crash also last week or earlier in the week. And he was, again, in quotes, supposedly kidnapped and held captive for 40 days in an Iraq jail. David Carr of the New York Times also died in that 24-hour period after interviewing Edward Snowden and had just come out against Brian Williams from NBC while on CBS. Now, again, I'm not making any connections there. Anyway, he was calling Williams out for lying about being shot down in the Iraq War. So the common denominator here seems to be Iraq, Iraq, Iraq. Bob Hager, the NBC aviation expert, recently had a head-on crash. Now, he has survived that, but it was a close call. And then, of course, Brian Williams off the air for at least 6 months for lying about the Iraq War. Three journalists dead, one seriously injured, all within a 24-hour period, and all taking place inside the United States. Did they know something we don't know? The article goes on to say, is there a current campaign to silence the truth? Someone's connecting some dots, apparently. A coincidence? Well, hard to say. Things are never as they appear. However, I'll dig a little deeper into that story. But it is interesting that you had three mainstream, two of them with network news organizations on television, NBC, CBS, and another with the New York Times, all dying within that 24-hour period. Award-winning writer, editor, and broadcaster Stephen Kimber is standing by to share a remarkable story, one you may not even be aware of. It's kind of a forgotten chapter in history. It's the real story of the Cuban Five. And he'll join me in just a few moments. I want to remind you that tickets are now available for my Follow the Truth 2 conference happening in the evening on Sunday, April the 26th at the Region Theater in Oshawa. Check out the complete list of speakers and the agenda at the website www.followthetruth.tv, followthetruth.tv. And we've just added Dr. John Hall, noted medical expert on electronic harassment and mind control. He's going to be flying in from his home in San Antonio. And he's got a brand new book out. I'll see if you can see this on the HOA. I'll tell you a bit about that in a second. But it's called Guinea Pigs, Technologies of Control, Dr. John Hall. In fact, he'll be here on this program to talk about that and, again, his upcoming appearance at my conference, Follow the Truth, 2, April 26th. Rosemary Ellen Guiley will be there as well at the conference, live on stage conducting a paranormal experiment, which would be fun, inside the historic Region Theater with her spirit box. In fact, Rosemary will be the subject of my Follow the Truth trivia question at the bottom of the hour, where you can win a pair of tickets to the conference. And again, if you haven't ordered your tickets, do so this coming week. Our last conference in November was an overwhelming success, and this one is going to be very special. I'm very excited about it. The box office is 905-721-3399. 905-721-3399. And once again, we're conducting another Hangout on Air. You can live stream the program on YouTube and watch and listen to the show. It's very easy to do so. Just go to my Twitter page, at Richard Serrett, at Richard Serrett. Click on it's either the first or the second tweet in the feed, very near the top. Just click on the HOA live stream Feb 15th link, and you're in. And of course, while you're on my Twitter page, say hi and follow, please. That's at Richard Serrett. And if you want to tweet the Conspiracy Show, we've set up a hashtag for tonight. Very simple. It's hashtag TCS, as in The Conspiracy Show, hashtag TCS. And if you're watching and listening on the Hangout, we'd love to hear from you. Email us here at theconspiracyshow1, theconspiracyshow1 at gmail.com. All right, for the next 40 minutes or so, we're going to talk about terrorists who blow up airplanes and try to overthrow governments, and intelligence agents who try to stop them. The twist is that these terrorists are not radical Muslims, they're Cuban exiles, and the men trying to stop them are Cuban intelligence agents. The Cuban Five were dispatched to Florida in the early 1990s to infiltrate militant anti-Castro exile groups hatching terrorist attacks against their country. In 1998, the Cubans had passed on to the U.S. government information their agents had uncovered about a plot to blow up an airplane filled with Cuban beach-bound tourists. The FBI arrested not the terrorists plotting the attack, but get this, they arrested the agents trying to stop it. It all sounds like fiction, but it's true. And this remarkable and tragic chapter in American history is wonderfully documented in What Lies Across the Water, The Real Story of the Cuban Five. Stephen Kimber is an award-winning writer, editor, broadcaster, and teaches journalism at the University of King's College in Halifax, Canada. Stephen, welcome to The Conspiracy Show. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Thank you for having me, Richard.
Well, interesting times regarding Cuba, of course. A great easing of tension now between the two countries. First of all, let's dial it back to the early 90s, and let's step inside sort of the Cuban exile community living primarily in the Miami area. This is the area that's being infiltrated by these Cuban intelligence groups. So what is happening in the early 90s with these exile groups in Florida?
Well, essentially, the early 90s right after the fall of the Soviet Union, the exile groups in Miami that had long been hoping for Fidel Castro to be overthrown, to die, whatever, thought that this was their moment, that they had exactly what they wanted about to happen. And, you know, in a certain sense, if you look at it, it seemed to make sense. First of all, the Cubans had lost their Soviet support. And if you look across the Atlantic at Europe, where the old Soviet Empire fell apart, and, you know, the Czechs and the Slovaks, and, you know, it was the end of that kind of empire. And the Miami exiles expected that that would happen very quickly. It did not happen. The Cubans went through a very difficult economic time. What you had was what they called, Fidel Castro called, the special period in time of peace, which meant that people were literally starving in the early 1990s because the economy was in such bad shape. Fidel Castro turned to tourism, reluctantly, but he turned to tourism as a way out of this crisis for Cuba, and it began to work. People like us in Canada began to visit, Italians, the Spaniards, the Germans, there were tourist resorts built, and this upset to no end the exile community in Miami, and they began plotting attacks on Cuba that were intended to create a situation where people would be frightened to come to Cuba, that the tourism industry would collapse, and that therefore Fidel Castro would be forced out of power. That was the goal of all of this. In 1992, one of the very well-known groups in the United States, Cuban exile lobby groups, the Cuban American National Foundation, which has had links with American presidents going back to Ronald Reagan all through Clinton,
you have to court these groups if you want to carry Florida in the presidential election.
Absolutely, and presidents had done that over periods of time. So there was no question that Cuban exile community was very powerful in terms of Washington, in terms of policy, and their expectation was that they could get what they wanted very quickly. When it didn't happen, in 1992, the Cuban American National Foundation at a meeting in Naples, Florida, set up a paramilitary. Now, this is a lobby group, a really well-known, high-powered, high-profile lobby group, and they set up what amounted to a little paramilitary with helicopters and gunships and all sorts of other accoutrements of a military, a small military, to attack Cuba. There were attacks on Cuban hotels in 1997. There were more than a dozen hotels in Havana that were bombed. There was there was one person killed, an Italian-Canadian tourist who was visiting Cuba and trying to do business there, was killed in one of those explosions.
In Veradero, wasn't it?
Pardon me?
Was that in Veradero?
It was in Havana. Ah. It was a guy by the name of DeCelmo, Fabio DeCelmo.
Okay, let me just step in here, Stephen. We've got a break coming up. We'll come back and continue to discuss the Cuban Five. They were fighting terrorism, so why did the U.S. government put them in jail? Back with more of The Conspiracy Show right after this. Don't go away. Welcome back. Stephen Kimber is a journalism professor at the University of King's College in Halifax. He's an award-winning writer, editor, broadcaster, and the author of What Lies Across the Water, The Real Story of the Cuban Five. And sort of making us confront our prejudices about, who's wearing the white hats and the black hats when we think about American relations with Cuba, for example. Who are the terrorists and who are the freedom fighters, who are the, as I say, who are the good guys and who are the bad guys? Now, you were telling us about the activities of people like Rodolfo Frometa, who was a leader of one of these exile groups in Cuba, And, I mean, these were well-armed individuals. I mean, we're not talking about, potato guns here. They were trying to get their hands on things like Stinger missiles, correct?
They were, in fact, Fermetta was caught in a sting operation by the FBI trying to buy one of the Stinger missiles. Now, that was one of the rare instances where one of the exile groups was actually charged in the United States. What tended to happen was that the American law enforcement officials either looked the other way and just sort of let them go ahead and do what they did, or they would occasionally arrest somebody just to let them know that they were out there and that they shouldn't be quite so obvious with what they were doing. But basically, they let them get away with things. And, the American law enforcement knew much of what was going on in terms of these attacks on Cuba. But, of course, American policy was to, create regime change in Cuba. So, therefore, even though it was their policy not to participate in attacks directly, they certainly didn't try to stop them, which they should have, because these attacks on Cuba were in fact illegal under American law, under the U.S. Neutrality Act.
And they were targeting citizens, were they not?
They were, absolutely. They were targeting individuals. That's what made this terrorism, as opposed to going to, take your army in and fight the Castro army or whatever. It wasn't that. It was attacks against individual citizens, both Cubans and international citizens. So it was really what we would classify as terrorism, and that became one of the ironies when they were caught and sentenced right around the time of 9/11. That if you'd been able to flip this, and if in the case of the United States they had agents inside Al Qaeda in Afghanistan, and those agents were able to report back on the plot to attack the United States. And if that had happened and the Americans had turned around and confided in the Afghans what they'd learned, and the Afghans turned around and arrested, again, not the people who were plotting the attacks, but the American agents who'd uncovered it, we would never have heard the end of it. And that is the Cuban view of what happened in the case of the Cuban Five.
Right. I mean, I'm no fan of Castro, but simply because he's an avowed communist doesn't give another country, the right to unleash terror against that country. The hypocrisy is just, it's crushing, really.
It is the hypocrisy. I think that's the most damning part of all of this. The Cuban Five had infiltrated a number of different groups that were plotting these attacks.
Right. We should talk about this group. They're known as the La Red Avispa. What does that mean?
The WASP network. And they were a group actually of probably about two dozen agents who'd been sent over from Cuba to do essentially the same job, which was to infiltrate these various groups.
They were essentially spies, correct?
Cuban
spies. They were Cuban spies.
They were Cuban spies. A lot of people don't like the term spies. They prefer the term intelligence agents. But essentially, in our common understanding, spies, yes, that would cover it fairly well. But they were, sent with a specific mission, and that mission was to infiltrate these groups, report back, and then the Cubans would attempt to find ways to stop them. So there were a number of people who were arrested coming into Cuba with bomb-making equipment and that sort of stuff. Cuban state security was able to take the information that the intelligence agents provided, and whether it was to arrest the individuals or to destabilize a plot, they were successful in some instances, not successful in others. The bombing campaign in Havana in 1997, and then early in 1998, as you mentioned at the beginning of the show, the intelligence agents turned up this plot to blow up an airplane. And Fidel Castro realized that he could not, on his own, stop this particular plot. So he enlisted the aid of his good friend, the Nobel Prize-winning novelist Gabriel Garcia Marquez, who happened to be in Havana at the time, to carry a secret message to the United States, because he was going to Princeton University to do a workshop, and asked him to divert to Washington and meet with Bill Clinton and take this message about the plot to Bill Clinton.
Because Castro couldn't just pick up. There wasn't, you know, this red telephone like there was, you know, during the JFK Khrushchev era. He couldn't just pick up the red phone and say, hey, Bill, you know, we've got this plot we want to tell you about.
So no, in fact, you know, what it turns out is when in December, when the Cuban Five were actually released and this reset of Cuban-American relations began, Obama and Castro, Raul Castro, had a conversation on the phone, and I believe it was the first in 49 years that where the president had actually talked to his opposite number in the other country.
Right.
So yeah, there was no direct communication. This was a way of sending that message. And what we do know about that message and what happened was that the Clinton White House took the message from the Cubans seriously. They took what the Cubans said as something to be investigated. In fact, the Federal Aviation Administration in the United States issued a warning to airlines about the possibility of somebody trying to blow up a plane. So they believed it to that extent.
And this wasn't a military aircraft. This was filled with potentially tourists from Europe or maybe Latin America.
Could have
citizens.
Been hundreds of tourists. Right. Going to to Cuba for a couple of weeks on the beach, exactly what you know is probably happening every night this month and the next couple of months from Toronto, from Halifax, from London, from British Columbia. You know, planes going to Cuba carrying hundreds of tourists. One of those planes would have been blown up. That was the plan, and you know. The Americans, despite the you know bad relations with Cuba, did seem to take this very seriously. And there was something that happened in June of 1998 that was unprecedented, which was that a group of FBI agents from Washington and Miami flew to Havana, and they'd never had that kind of meeting with their counterparts in Cuban state security before. But they spent 3 days in Havana, and they met with Cuban state security at what they call a workhouse on the edge of town. And the Cubans gave them all kinds of information, the you know bomb fragments from the bombing campaigns that had gone on to date, you know, wiretap evidence that they had gathered. The Cubans were very good at knowing who was where and what they were up to. In fact, in one of the documents I saw that the Cubans turned over to the FBI, one of the key plotters from the Cuban the Cubans identified was a guy by the name of Luis Posada Carriles, and he's infamous in this world. He was involved prior to this in the 1976 attack on Cubana Airlines Flight 455, which in fact killed 76 people, and they knew so much about him that they knew where his mistress was, and so just as you know, gave the Americans information about that, so that they could track him down if they were looking for him.
As you point out, though, I mean, Carriles was brazen about this. I mean, he bragged about his involvement in the Havana bombings in the New York Times.
That's right. He told the New York Times, "I sleep like a baby." When somebody suggested to him, you know, what about this Italian Canadian who was killed? He said, you know, he was in the wrong place at the wrong time. I sleep like a baby. And he not only confessed to his involvement, but he confessed that he was financed in large part by Cuban American National Foundation. So, you know, he linked what he was doing back to the Cuban American National Foundation, and I think that was a significant confession on his part.
Sure. Let me just remind listeners, Stephen Kimber is with us, the author of What Lies Across the Water, The Real Story of the Cuban Five. Now, this Cuban intelligence network inside Cuba, now, were there more than five?
I counted up to about two dozen. And, there were... the way it worked was that they reported there were agents who sort of they were all independent of one another. We talk about it as a network, but in fact, it wasn't so much a network as the fact is that they all communicated with a couple of what they call illegal agents. These are agents who sneak into the country and operate under false identities, whereas most of the agents who were there were in fact people who they'd been Cuban Americans, or they pretended to steal a plane or come as a rafter. They had all sorts of cover stories that got them into the United States. And then they got regular jobs, and they didn't appear to be any different than any other Cuban exile. But in fact, they were reporting back to Havana on what they discovered. So there were about two dozen. Some had gone back to Cuba by the time that the arrests were made. Others, there were 10 of them arrested altogether. This is in September of 1998, and five of them very quickly turned state's evidence, copped a plea, and were therefore out of the mix. The five were the ones who stood up and said, "Yes, we did this, and we did it." And their defense, in a sense, became necessity.
All right, we should just
because
explain.
The Americans would not stop these plots. The Cubans had no alternative but to stop them on their own, and therefore there was a justification defense for their work in the United States.
These five agents
with the courts in Miami, but that was the defense.
So these five agents that were arrested in Florida. What were the circumstances? How were they found out? And again, these are the agents that are providing the intel that foiled some of these terrorist plots, primarily this 1998 plot to bomb a Cuban airliner. So how were they caught?
No, they were caught. It gets complicated here. After the meeting with the FBI in June of 1998, the FBI went away and said, "We're going to investigate and we will get back to you." And even to this day, the Cubans that I've talked to who are involved in state security say they believe that those American agents were serious and sincere about what they said they were going to do. But somewhere between June and September, things changed. And they came and arrested these guys. And it wasn't that the FBI didn't know about them. In fact, the FBI had known about them for at least 2 years. They'd been following them, and nobody is quite sure how they got onto them in the first place. But they had been following them, and I'm guessing that what happened is they'd find one, and they'd follow him to a rendezvous with another, and once they sort of identified who was the key player in all this, and that was a guy named Gerardo Hernandez, they were able to sort of identify who the other players were.
Okay, we've got that music coming up here again, Stephen, so we'll take another time out. We'll come back and continue to discuss the Cuban Five. They were fighting terrorism, but instead of arresting the terrorists, they put the Cuban Five in jail, where they languished for many, many years. Back with more of my conversation with Stephen when we come back here on The Conspiracy Show. Stay with us. And we'll get back to our conversation with Stephen Kimber, author of What Lies Across the Water, The Real Story of the Cuban Five, here in just a moment. It's time for our trivia question for Follow the Truth, your chance to win a pair of tickets to my conference, Follow the Truth 2, happening Sunday, April the 26th at the Regent Theater. Now, one of our speakers is Rosemary Ellen Guiley, our paranormal investigator who joins us on this program once a month. And she'll be flying in with her spirit boxes to perform a little paranormal experiment live on stage at the historic Regent Theater. Now, here's the question. I'll take the seventh correct caller who can answer this question. The phone lines are open now at 416-360-0740, 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740, 866-740-4740. Rosemary Ellen Guiley co-wrote a book with George Norrie, the host of Coast to Coast AM. What is the title of that book? Co-authored by Rosemary Ellen Guiley and George Norrie. We'll take the seventh caller, Tim Spreen, standing by. We'll take the seventh correct caller, and the correct answer will get you a pair of ducats to Follow the Truth 2, happening April 26th at the Regent Theater in Oshawa. All right, back to Stephen Kimber, award-winning writer, editor, broadcaster, a journalism professor at the University of King's College in Halifax. And first of all, let's get back to the arrests. Now, they tracked them down, and we should also point out that these five are known sort of affectionately in Cuba by their first names. I mean, there are pictures of them all over the island. Stephen, what are their first names?
There's Gerardo. Gerardo is the leader of the group. He was the key illegal intelligence agent. There were two agents, operating agents. One was a guy by the name of René González, and the other was Antonio Guerrero. And then there were two other illegal agents, Ramón Labanino and Fernando González. So they, and as you say, if you go to Cuba, if you were to go to Cuba and go to a school, talk to little kids, they could, you know, they were Los Cinco. They were these people that they knew as heroes, as national heroes. And you can understand why. I mean, forget the communist issue for the moment. These are guys who prevented terrorist attacks against their country, and they paid a horrible price for it. So, you know, you can understand why they would have been heroes.
Right, and they saved the lives, not necessarily just of Cubans. Again, these could have been European tourists, tourists from Central America, perhaps even, who knows, someone from Canada.
Oh, absolutely. So, yes, they were, you know, protecting us as well as Cubans themselves. No question about that.
Now, were any of the Cuban five sort of embedded in a undercover in a military base?
One of them was, and this became part of the issue in the American courts. They were some of them were charged with conspiracy to commit espionage. When because of the fact that they didn't in fact commit espionage, it was conspiracy to commit, which is a catch-all and makes it easier to prove. If you at some point in your life said maybe this might be something I would do, then that is enough to justify a conspiracy charge. And so they were charged with conspiracy to commit espionage. One of them, Antonio Guerrero, he worked on a military base, Boca Chica Naval Station in Florida. He was a janitor. He got the job because he went to an employment office, and the employment officer felt sorry for him and sent him to, first of all, dig ditches on the military base. He rose to be a janitor. He certainly didn't have access to military secrets. The reasons that the Cubans wanted their agents in the military bases was defensive. If you look at the example in the 1980s and 90s, you had Haiti, Panama, Grenada, where the Americans had invaded for a variety of reasons. The Cubans certainly felt vulnerable and thought that they could be subjects of that kind of invasion. So So that having people on these bases, even in a non-secure kind of role, allowed them to get the kind of information that they needed. For example, they had come up with a checklist of things to watch for, and while they were sort of watching for these things, these were signs that there might be an invasion. So suddenly, a lot of brass hats come down to Florida from the northern bases, or a bunch of jets show up where they hadn't been before. There's high security alerts. Those were the kind of signs that there could be an invasion imminent. And so he could, Antonio could see that kind of information from his job. He could have seen it from the highway. You would see these planes or whatever. So it wasn't it was a military mission, but it wasn't the kind of military mission that we think of when you're stealing national secrets or anything like that. So they weren't doing that, for sure.
All right. When we come back, we'll talk about one claim that one of the Cuban Five, Gerardo, may have been involved in a conspiracy with the shootdown 3 years earlier of two Brothers to the Rescue airlift. This is another anti-Castro group that had been rescuing rafters of those people fleeing Castro's Cuba in the Straits of Florida. We'll find out whether there's any validity to that charge. And we'll also find out what happened to the Cuban Five. Where are they? Are they still languishing in prison? Back with more of my conversation with Stephen Kimber, author of What Lies Across the Water, the real story of the Cuban Five, right here on The Conspiracy Show. Don't go away. Hey, congratulations to Tony Morsi of Toronto, who won a pair of tickets to Follow the Truth 2, April 26th at the Regent Theatre in Oshawa. And he did so by being the seventh correct caller and answering our Follow the Truth trivia question for this week, which was the name of the book co-authored by one of our speakers at the conference, Rosemary Ellen Guiley, a regular on the program, a book she co-authored with Coast to Coast AM's George Nori. And the name of that book is Talking to the Dead. And she'll be attempting a spirit communication experiment when she joins us at the Regent Theatre. Again, followthetruth.tv. All of the speaker bios, all of the details for the conference are all right there. Followthetruth.tv. All right, back with Stephen Kimber, award-winning writer, editor, broadcaster, and professor of journalism at University of King's College in Halifax. We're talking about the Cuban Five. Now, one of the five of this Cuban intelligence group, Gerardo, was somehow connected, allegedly, to the shooting down of an anti-Castro plane, or a group called Brothers to the Rescue. This was a plane, and the Brothers to the Rescue aircraft was supposedly trying to pick up rafters that were fleeing Cuba in the Straits of Florida. Any validity to that charge, that Gerardo may have been involved in the shooting down of that plane?
Reality was that they had infiltrated Brothers to the Rescue. Brothers to the Rescue was, as you say, a humanitarian organization at one level, and it was actively involved in helping rafters who were trying to escape from Cuba. But as a result of an agreement between Cuba and the United States in 1994, they really didn't have any rafters to rescue anymore. In fact, the last 1,800 missions they flew, they didn't find one rafter to rescue. Instead, they became agents provocateur, and they would fly their planes into Cuban airspace, dropping leaflets and other things on the city. The Cubans protested. The Americans tried to stop this group from doing that. They didn't have much luck. They threatened to suspend their pilot's licenses, but that didn't have anything to do. So the Cubans had been threatening over a period of about 7 months, if you don't stop these guys, we will. And they did in the end blow them out of the water, and a number of people were killed. And you can certainly make the case that the Cubans should not have done that. I mean, there are arguments that say that they had a right to given that these guys were violating their airspace. And because of the work of the Cuban Five, they knew that this same group had been test firing missiles from some of those planes. So it wasn't a stretch to think that they might have been doing something more than just dropping leaflets. But having said that, I went through the evidence. There were more than 20,000 pages of trial transcript. There were boxes of evidence presented. And I looked very carefully at this particular allegation because it is clearly the most serious. And I was not able to find any compelling evidence to suggest that Gerardo Hernandez was involved. The reality is that the exile community in Miami wanted somebody to pay the price for this shootdown. They were not in a position to indict Fidel Castro, who is the person they most wanted to blame for this and hold accountable for it. Gerardo Hernandez was convenient. And so I think that was the reason he was charged. He wasn't charged till 7 months after the other charges were laid against these people. And the most interesting thing is at the end of the trial, after the prosecution had presented its evidence, defense had presented its, the judge instructed the jury, and the prosecutors rushed off to the courthouse and said that based on the judge's instructions to the jury, they didn't believe that they had in fact presented the evidence that would convict, and they believed that they hadn't produced the compelling evidence in this case. The appeal court simply said, let the jury decide. The reality was a jury in Miami is not going to decide in favor of five Cuban government employees.
They actually held the trial in Miami? I mean, what kind of a defense attorney would hold the trial in the heart of the Cuban exile community? That's ridiculous.
The defense lawyers tried on numerous occasions to have a change of venue because of the fact that this was the wrong place to hold this kind of trial, and they got turned down. So it did not at the end of the trial, it didn't take the jury long at all to decide that these guys were guilty of every charge against them. They were convicted and sentenced to incredibly long prison terms. Gerardo Hernandez, for example, was given a double life plus 15-year sentence. Two of the others were given life sentences that were later commuted to slightly lesser sentences. So, you know, these were pretty powerful sentences that were handed out to these guys.
Did you ever meet with
2000, actually, after the trial?
Right, just over 15 years ago. Did you ever meet with or speak with any of the Cuban Five?
I have not to this point. In the United States, it was impossible for me to get in to see any of them in prison. And Gerardo, for example, was in a maximum security prison in California. He wasn't allowed even to use the prison email system, which, you know, murderers and others had been able to do. So our correspondence was all by the old snail mail, and his letters were all handwritten to me. And we had dozens of letters back and forth as I tried to sort of ask them questions and get more information.
And so it was mainly Gerardo that you corresponded with?
I corresponded with all
oh,
of
did.
Them, primarily Gerardo and Rene Gonzalez, who was he had stolen a plane technically in 1990 and defected to the United States. And of course he was always a Cuban intelligence agent. So he was in fact doing that undercover work.
Right.
He and I had a long correspondence. He was the first one to get out about 2 years ago and get back to Havana. But he got out because he had served his entire sentence.
Of 13 years.
Yep.
And that was one of the lesser sentences.
That's right. 15 years was the least of the sentences.
When you were corresponding with them, what was their mood like? Were they completely befuddled as to why, instead of being hailed as heroes and saving lives, they were arrested and thrown in jail?
I don't think they were befuddled. I think that they were... they're very interesting characters because they don't... They didn't hold a grudge about against the American people. They didn't seem to. In prison, they were model prisoners. One who barely spoke English when he got into prison became a teacher of other inmates, trying to get them to learn English so that they could pass their GEDs. They decided when they got into prison that they were going to make use of the time there. Rene Gonzalez, for example, ran half marathons in prison. Antonio became a poet and a painter. Gerardo ran in many ways. He was the most active person in terms of his own defense, and the solidarity. What had happened over the years is that a kind of a solidarity movement grew up around these guys. It was international. It wasn't that big in the United States, but it certainly was big in Italy and Spain and Germany and England, where there were groups formed to try and convince the Americans that these guys had been unjustly in prison.
Were there no discussions about prisoner exchanges? I'm sure that there must be U.S. intelligence agents languishing somewhere in a Cuban prison. Were there discussions of that?
There was a man named Alan Gross, who was an American U.S. aid subcontractor, who was arrested in Cuba in 2009. And he was bringing in sort of sophisticated telecommunications equipment. He was sentenced to 15 years in prison. And the Cubans had said, pretty much from the get-go, that they would be willing to have a humanitarian exchange. They would send him back in exchange for the Cuban Five. And by the end of the whole saga, there were only three of the five left. The first one, Rene had mentioned, got out, and last February, Fernando had ended up serving his whole sentence. For most of the time, the Americans had said, no way, there's no equivalence between this guy, Alan Gross, who was a humanitarian do-gooder, which was not quite true, but that was the argument, that he was somebody who was not an intelligence agent or a spy like these other guys, and therefore there couldn't be any equivalence. But what we didn't know was that beginning in June of 2013, the Americans had approached the Cubans from the highest levels about a discussion about an exchange. And that went on for 18 months. And then in December, just about a month and a half ago, out of the blue, there was an announcement that, there was going to be a prisoner exchange. The three remaining members of the Cuban Five went home to Cuba. Alan Gross came home to the United States. And there was another intelligence agent that nobody had heard of before, an American intelligence agent, or I shouldn't say that, he was a Cuban who had given the Americans information back in the mid-1990s and had been arrested and served 20 years in prison in Cuba. And the Americans used that. They got him out. I don't think they particularly cared about him, but they got him out, and they were able to use that to say that they hadn't traded for Alan Gross, that Alan Gross was just a humanitarian gesture that the Cubans had made.
Right.
Ultimately, doesn't matter.
Right.
They're all now home. Gerardo Hernandez, who'd been denied access to even see his wife for most of that time, and they'd been hoping to have children, thanks to the – and this becomes a complicated story, but thanks to the intervention of the Pope during the secret negotiations he was allowed to provide his sperm through artificial insemination. And shortly after he returned to Cuba, they had their baby girl.
Remarkable. Just about out of time here, Stephen. But what has the reaction been to your book in, for example, the exile community in Florida?
I would say that probably in the exile community in Florida, it's not at the top of the bestseller list. But, you know, I think that there's even a big change in Florida now. And people, a lot of people in Florida who are not part of the very old guard now see that, you know, it makes sense, even if what you want is to have regime change, it makes sense to have relations with Cuba and not to see them as somebody that you want to defeat.
No, I mean, what has been accomplished?
The conventional kind of way.
What has been accomplished in the last 50 years, 50 plus years, 55 years? Nothing.
Nothing. Absolutely nothing. And you know, if Cuba is going to change, it's probably going to change on its own, and it is changing actually now. And so I don't think that the embargo has done any good, and the posturing hasn't done any good. So it's certainly time to try something new and different.
Well, congratulations on what lies across the water, the real story of the Cuban Five. This is a chapter most people are not familiar with, and I applaud you for bringing it to all of our attention. Thanks so much, Stephen.
Thank you for having me on the show. I really appreciate it. Take care.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye now.
Stephen Kimber, award-winning writer, editor, and broadcaster, and the author of What Lies Across the Water, the Real Story of the Cuban Five. Hey, we will direct you now to the website, richardserrett.com, your portal to The Conspiracy Show. Check it out. Past show archives. If you're not a member, register. It's easy to do. And, of course, say hello on Twitter at Richard Serrett. And just a friendly reminder, always follow the truth. There we go. Push the red button. Hey, thanks for inviting me into your home. It's about minus 31. Maybe it froze. Maybe that's the problem. The button froze. We are broadcasting to you live from the Liberty Village neighborhood of Toronto and blasting your way out of the Great White North from our flagship station, AM 740 Zoomer Radio. And now available in the United States in about 32 markets and growing. And we just added two more affiliates this week. KFEQ AM, St. Joseph, Missouri. KFEQ AM, St. Joseph, Missouri, and WFEB AM in Birmingham, Alabama. WFEB AM, Birmingham, Alabama. Thanks to both of those stations for adding The Conspiracy Show to their schedule. We're very honored to be aboard. Once again, we're doing an HOA, a hangout on air. For all of you techno peasants like myself, I just recently learned about HOAs, thanks to, in large part, to our capable young intern, Albert, who's in studio monitoring. And if you want to watch the live stream of The Conspiracy Show, it's fast and it's easy. Just go to my Twitter feed, at Richard Serrett, and click on the tweet. It's at or near the top. It says HOA live stream Feb 15th. And now you're inside the studio here with me, and you'll also be able to see my guest and, of course, hear the program. And while you're on my Twitter feed, say hi and be sure to follow. That's at Richard Serrett. And, of course, you can email me at theconspiracyshow1@gmail.com. Speaking of Twitter, we've set up a hashtag for the program tonight. If you want to tweet, it's hashtag TCS. Hashtag. Now, is that case sensitive, Albert? Do they all have to be caps?
Not case sensitive.
It's not case sensitive. All right. So hashtag TCS, of course, that stands for The Conspiracy Show. And I want to give this story a quick mention before we begin, because speaking of tweets, again, this has gone absolutely viral. Outgoing aide to President Barack Obama, John Podesta, recently tweeted, "Finally, my biggest failure of 2014, once again not securing the disclosure of the UFO files, hashtag disclosure of the UFO files." And the story was picked up by the Washington Post, no less. And Podesta, of course, served in Bill Clinton's White House as an aide and then became part of President Barack Obama-elect's transition team and then became an aide to Obama. And if you're not familiar with John Podesta, huge X-Files fan and extraterrestrial fan, and has talked about, you know, wanting very much to disclose UFO files. He says not only is it important, it's the law. And yet here he is tweeting as he prepares to leave the Obama White House to join Hillary Clinton's campaign. although that hasn't officially launched yet, and she's expected to be the shoe-in. So imagine now, let's face it, here's what's going to happen, right? It's going to be Clinton versus Bush yet again, this pre-approved slate of candidates. And if she joins Clinton's campaign and she wins, and Podesta becomes a part of her transition team and then becomes an aide, which is usually what happens, do you think Podesta will actually set himself up to fail again and not successfully disclose the UFO files? This is a huge story, and I can tell you it has caused a tremendous buzz inside the UFO disclosure community. They're looking at this one simple tweet from John Podesta as a major victory, a major step forward in the disclosure movement. Just a reminder, next week on the program, my good pal, Dr. John Hall, will join us to talk about his new book, Electronic Harassment and Mind Control. The new book is entitled Guinea Pigs, Technologies of Control. And a great deal of Dr. Hall's practice, he's down in San Antonio, is involved with, I mean, he's primarily a pain management specialist, but a great deal of his cases now deal with alleged victims of electronic harassment. And John will be flying up from Texas for my live conference, Follow the Truth 2, happening in the evening of Sunday, April the 26th at the Region Theater. And again, followthetruth.tv for all the details, all the speakers, their bios, the agenda. And for tickets, again, the box office at the Region Theater, 905-721-3399. 905-721-3399. And again, that's the Region Theater, Sunday, April the 26th. Follow the Truth 2 website for details, followthetruth.tv. I'll tell you what, I am really looking forward to the next 40-plus minutes. As my old media scientist friend Nelson Thal likes to say, it's after midnight and the owners of the system are asleep. Now we can play. We are going to talk here with an independent producer on how the occult affects us all. We spend a lot of time talking about the occult on this program. And my guest has made hundreds of hours of documentaries on, for example, the Illuminati's use of the dark arts in politics, movies, and music. And you're going to learn what you need to know to keep your family safe from mind control, learn the true meaning of symbols around you, witness high-profile rituals being performed on network television, you know, during the Grammys, for example, and during the halftime show at the Super Bowl. We'll get into that. Has Satan removed his disguise? This is where the esoteric meets the political. Freeman Fly is an internationally known award-winning TV producer, filmmaker, radio talk show host, and lecturer. Freeman is considered an expert in the fields of the occult, trauma-based mind control, speaking of Dr. John Hall and others, Illuminati symbolism, and ancient civilizations. He graduated with an Associates of Arts with honors in interdisciplinary studies and attended Kansas University, specializing in ancient and environmental architecture. He's lectured extensively on the secret signs and symbolism of Freemasonry, the ancient astronaut hypothesis, trauma-based mind control, social engineering, government conspiracy, human cloning, technology of the future, and synchronicity. Freeman Fly, welcome to the Conspiracy Show. How are you?
Wow, I'm fantastic.
Great to have you with us, and thanks for joining us on our Hangout on Air. Let's just jump right in, and I want to ask you about the Super Bowl, the halftime show. Was this an example, and we're speaking of Katy Perry, for example, for instance, you know, riding in on this giant tiger. Were we witnessing a high-profile ritual during the halftime show at the Super Bowl?
What I can say is that we predicted what you would actually see. And I don't know of anyone else that had done this, and the odds of it were amazing. And you can actually watch us live as we were broadcasting through a Hangout on Air during the Super Bowl and see our reaction and the exact depiction that we are already prepared for, because we knew.
Now, when you say you knew what was going to happen, go into that a little bit. Do you mean you predicted the actual content of the show, that she was going to ride in on this large sort of robotic-looking tiger, or what did you predict exactly?
That is correct. We are expected to be able to predict these sort of things, and we have been working on a science database and have been consistent so far over 10 years of being able to state what you were going to witness in these high-profile rituals. It's been mind-boggling and mind-blowing if we get into Madonna and talk about her Super Bowl ritual, but we'll get to that. We actually are focused on a magical order known as the Ordo Templi Orientis, and really the magical practices of an order known as the Typhonian Order, which is an order related to the abyss and the beast. And it always goes back to this dark magic. So when we looked to see what we were going to predict, and I say we because my wife Jamie is involved in all of this, and you'll be having her on the show here.
She's with us next week, yes.
All right. So we were able to say, okay, look, this is the magic that's being practiced. We're looking inside of the OTO sexual magical rituals, and then we look into their symbolism and what it is that they would want to depict. And when you start to study even, rocket propulsion systems, you are going to end up in the occult. So Jack Parsons of Jet Propulsion Laboratories plays a role in this prediction, as does L. Ron Hubbard and Aleister Crowley.
Wow.
So as we looked and researched their concept of the Whore of Babylon, what they call the Whore of Abominations and the Whore of Babylon, this is their lead goddess inside of this magical order. And you will see the Scarlet Woman represented all the time. You will find her on the Beatles albums. You will find her on the Rolling Stones albums. You will find her depicted in Hollywood and things like Battlestar Galactica. The Matrix made note of the woman in the red dress.
Isn't she also riding, she's on a bull, and that's the symbol of the European Union, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
Is that the same, the Whore of Babylon?
That does go back to Inanna and Ishtar, which is related to this goddess when she's stated on a bull or a lion. But this is not exactly that,
okay.
No.
All right. So the tiger that Katy Perry rode in on during the halftime show.
Yeah, it should have been the tiger, right? Because she was singing about the tiger.
Sure.
But and you can go listen to our prediction. We read the vision of L. Ron Hubbard with Jack Carson, and their vision of the Whore of Babylon, as they saw her coming in on a cat-like beast, holding the rein, and in the vision she would be holding a grail, and the grail would be encompassed in flames. But instead, Katie became the grail. And her costume was the flame, and she was riding astride the beast, holding the rein, exactly as described in the vision of the Whore of Babylon. Now, this is a magical reference to an archetypal force that this group focuses on. You know, the whole heart of Thelema, of the magical practices of the OTO, go to the Scarlet Woman. And so you would see that she was actually on a lion. And then we added an additional fact to the prediction, saying that she would also be represented with diamonds, because within the trauma-based mind control system, diamonds represent a presidential model mind control slave. So we said that it would be a cat-like beast with diamonds. So we even called it to that specific. And it is there on the website for everyone to see.
Freeman Fly is with us as we discuss the occult, and we've linked up to Freeman's website. You just go to richardserra.com and click on Freeman's name there, and it'll take you to Freeman TV, freemantv.com, and we'll continue to talk about these high-profile rituals, the Super Bowl, the Grammys, for example. The Illuminati's fingerprints in politics and art and music. All of that and much more. Aliens from Hell, time permitting as well, with Freeman Fly right here on The Conspiracy Show. Stay with us. And we've also started a hashtag if you want to tweet us. It's hashtag TCS. That's hashtag T as in the C as in conspiracy, S as in show, hashtag TCS. Freeman Fly is with us as we discuss the occult and high-profile rituals. We were talking about Perry's performance at the Super Bowl. Now, the 57th Grammys, I mean, this one was just right in your face, obviously, Madonna and her song Living for Love. She was wearing, of course, devil horns and Illuminati Baphomet masks. I mean, it's pretty overt now, isn't it? What is that? They're not even trying to hide it. What's the idea that things are ramping up to the point where they're basically just getting right in our grill with this stuff? What's going on, Freeman?
Yes, definitely. We refer to that as a revelation of the method. And we believe that, yes, they are trying to lay this whole program out for everyone and get those involved that want to be involved. The OTO has even got Google ads on my website now that I'm talking about them so much. But they started with an infiltration, putting Aleister Crowley books in every single store out there. You could get these magical works, and it started to fill the lodges with these people that were practicing, you know, starting to learn this form of magic. To the point then that they started to couple this into the music industry, and like Lady Gaga in her Rolling Stone interview said that she had witnessed a dream, actually, of a Illuminati ritual where she had some girl laid down. She was slicing her wrist and pouring honey on the wounds. And in the Rolling Stone article, her mother states, oh, well, that's an Illuminati ritual. And I'm like, well, how does she know this? And why are they talking about this on Rolling Stone? You know, this is the level that it's come. Of course, Lady Gaga doing blood rituals, sacrifices under a burning angel on American Idol, you know, primetime television, and we're witnessing blood sacrifices on television.
Now, how does this happen to people like, let's say, you know, Katy Perry, who seems, at least on the surface, to be a wonderfully talented young woman? You know, wholesome even. I've seen her on talk shows when she seems very, you know, proper and seems to have, you know, kind of a positive message. How does this happen to people like her and Beyonce and others? Are they mind controlled?
Well, as you look into the roots in each of these situations, you will find consistent patterns. We've also outlined signs of mind control, and would align them with imagery. You could find just tons of images to associate with the mind control symbolism with each of these celebrities. But you need to look into their past and then who has also raised them and look for handlers. And when we look to Katy Perry's case, it's very much like an Aleister Crowley situation where she was a very good Christian. Beyonce would say the same thing as well, that her whole dedication was to nothing but God. And Katy Perry wanted to be a gospel singer like Amy Grant. But then, as all of them openly state, they sell their soul to the devil. Now, they openly admit this. Now, I'm personally not a fundamental Christian, so I'm looking at this without a stated black and white imagery of, you know, selling your soul to the devil and what they mean by this, right? Because I look at the occult, this picture becomes much more of a tapestry, and it doesn't simply become black and white. So Katy Perry, once the Hunger Games did a really good job of showing this situation to you, that once you're pulled into this game, they hold you. They separate you from your friends and your family. You'll see this with, like, Beyonce and her group. They separated her out so that the friends couldn't be around there as a nurturing social aspect. They need to separate them. And then they utilize these icons over and over again to institute social engineering campaigns. Katy Perry constantly seen in Barack Obama garb, constantly promoting this. But then what we mostly see out of these icons is the ritual aspects of the Tower of Babylon. And, you know, Miley Cyrus did the same thing where she stuck out her tongue. That was actually a representation of Kali, which is also another form of this same Scarlet Woman. They would say she is Kali. And then Madonna, we saw the same situation. Now, Madonna's an interesting case. because she is one that's a willing participant inside of a Kabbalistic practice. She goes off into cemeteries with rabbis and performs these rituals in the, you know, full. She openly admitted that her Super Bowl ritual was a 20 or 33 minute sermon when she came out. And then she displayed what this magical practice considers the mark of the beast over and over again on stage so many times that you could barely count them.
Now, what happens to performers, artists, who try to break free? What I'm wondering about is, let's say someone, for example, like a Britney Spears. I'm wondering if her, you know, much, not celebrated, but certainly we, you know, it was highly scrutinized. Her breakdown in front of, you know, millions of people that was scrutinized by the media, or someone like a Justin Bieber. Are these, and we're speculating here, obviously, but do you surmise that perhaps these are individuals who wanted to break out of this, whether they were controlled by the Ordo Templi Orientis or not, and because they tried to break free, they were, I don't know, somehow discredited or made to look bad, because obviously they fell out of favor. Certainly Britney Spears did and is starting to come back a little bit now. But what is your take on artists who try to break free? Is it possible?
Now, I did do a deep, in-depth study of Anna Nicole, Britney, and Mind Control. It was my second DVD, and really put this whole concept out there into the public eye, because we could witness these situations as they unfolded live on television. So with the situation of Britney Spears, you again start to research her past and you start to look into her situation, and you find that she's consistent with a programmed multiple. She has many personalities. Now, this is a common trait that we're seeing in these icons that are consistent. Beyoncé has Beyoncé or Sasha Fierce. Nicki Minaj has Roman Zelansky and so on, even Eminem, you know, and his Slim Shady. So Britney actually had a number of multiple identities, and one was so satanic that it frightened her bodyguard. He came out on Montel and was saying how frightened he was by Britney and her satanic practice. Now, what happened with Britney is when you start to look into these ritual aspects, they use blonde-haired goddesses as their ritual incarnations. The goddesses are used, or these women are used to incarnate entities, or what they call demons, into the soul. And they prefer the blonde-haired, blue-eyed. So when Britney went into Esther's hair salon, and there's a whole connection to Esther in this magical practice, she shaved her head bald and said that she did not want them touching her anymore. She didn't want them using her anymore. And this was a defiance to being this high priestess and the goddess, because she had, you know, shaved off her blonde hair. Now, one note was that when she shaved her hair was actually brown. So this was maybe the first defiance to say, okay, I'm not your blonde goddess. And when that maybe didn't pan out, she shaved her head. Now, then she was brought to an institution, and I believe it might have been Promises Clinic. She was brought into Crossroads, which has the deal with the devil with Robert Johnson. And that, these institutions seem to be involved in the reprogramming of these people. She checks herself into Promises Clinic, and next thing you know, she's running around screaming she's the Antichrist. She scrawls 666 on her forehead and then attempts to hang herself. Now, does this seem like a normal situation here?
Oh, this is absolutely tragic. It's horrible.
And I can go on and on with numerous different celebrities in this type of relationship.
Well, what about young Justin Bieber, who is just totally self-destructed?
Yes, this poor guy. You know, when we look at his situation, we see that the current programming, we're always looking into what the social engineers are after, and when you're looking to this, you're really looking at Satanists, and you got to understand the true properties of what makes a Satanist. It's not just devil worship. It's something, it's a belief system that really is in power. And so pedophilia is at the height of the Satanist agenda at this time. And so Justin Bieber has been utilized in this way.
Okay, we have to be careful about this now. These are allegations.
I was going to give an example.
Okay.
Of how this social engineering would work. So at the Music Awards, I'm not sure which one, Justin Bieber, Kim Kardashian was left standing on camera in front of Justin Bieber's dressing room saying, I can't wait to get this little boy. Now, he was only 15 maybe at this time. So they were openly promoting. I kept thinking as I was watching this, what if that was Willow Smith in that room and Kanye West standing outside the door saying, I can't wait to make it with this little girl. But it was okay because it was a 15-year-old boy. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, so totally inappropriate.
Example.
Yeah, totally inappropriate.
Yeah.
So he has been really victimized, and I don't know about the other, serious allegation, and I don't know about that,
we keep going deeper and deeper. We have Corey Feldman coming out completely about the pedophilic agenda that he had to deal with while rising up in Hollywood. He's now written choreography. And then we have Chuck Barris, our lovely host of The Gong Show and The Dating Game, coming forward and almost admitting that he was a contract killer for the CIA while taking the contestants on their surprise vacation.
I remember that, yes. I remember when, he wrote a book about it.
Yeah.
So the other thing I wanted to ask you about is the flashing of signs. We see this on TV and on the Grammys, and we see pictures all over the internet of, supposed the devil horns and so forth. And to me, that's a little tricky because, you got a very fast, shutter speed, and someone's moving their hands and their fingers. You can capture that one nanosecond of an instant where they look to be flashing the devil horns, and they're not necessarily. But what's behind the appearance of this constant flashing of these devil horns, and maybe there are some other hand signals that you could let us in on?
Yeah, absolutely. You can just capture somebody in a weird hand position, and I think people do read into a lot of this. What you should look for are the definitive hand signs that people are purposely making in magazine covers and different situations that they intend this in. So, like the secret hand, the Napoleon hand into the shirt, that's a Masonic Templar symbolism that you would use to say that you're in the secret hand. There's what people are calling the 666 symbolism, or the OK sign that people have been holding in front of their head. Now, this is an ancient symbol of the goddess going back to the Vesica Piscea that actually means you're in the womb. And so a lot of the hand signs and gestures that people are seeing are not exactly what they think they are, because people don't tend to study magic as a practice. And I have a whole section here just to do that very thing. So when you see people putting the triangle in front of their eye and people say, oh, it's the eye of the Illuminati, when you look into magical practice, this is actually the triangle of manifestation, and is actually used during a ritual to incarnate a demon or an entity into another person, another body, a recipient. So that's what that eye and the triangle symbol actually is within magical practices.
You mentioned the OTO, the Ordo Templi Orientis. Now, are they similar to the Masons, the Freemasons? They're a fraternal organization, but what is the relationship with the Masons?
Okay, well, many Masons will be members of the OTO, but they will not admit it inside of a Masonic lodge. If they're inside the OTO lodge, they'll openly admit their Freemasonic connection. Now, the OTO is an outer body. It is reputed to be descended of the Bavarian Illuminati and tracing its roots all the way back to the Knights Templar. And the practices within the OTO are actually sex magic rituals, sometimes coupled with trauma-based mind control. When you look into many of the practices that Crowley did in his early practices in traumatizing the people that he was putting through the ritual, even to the point of branding them with the mark of the beast for his scarlet woman. They would often get branded. And then very sick, perverted rituals that require feces and sex and anal rape. And these are the deeper inner mysteries of the OTO. So many Freemasons will be members because they follow, once you get into that path, like you go into Freemasonry, you start to learn that there's an occult faction inside of the world, and you realize that America would not have been created without the use of these occult practices. That's why there's pentagrams in the street plans of Washington, D.C. I mean, L'Enfant and Washington weren't goofing around when they did this. It took a lot of effort. And so all the signs and symbols that you see around you, even the goddess Columbia, our District of Columbia, is the internal goddess of this magical order. And so the traits within the magical order will raise you into you can go many different levels. There are numerous, numerous factions within these secret societies.
Right. And that's what we are talking about here, our secret societies. These are not, you know, necessarily mainstream Masons we're talking about here. We're talking about, you know, most organizations, when you get to a certain level, you know, they may have some rituals and some, you know, secret practices and so forth. So, you know, not to malign, I would gather that 99% of, you know, Freemasons know nothing about this. They're out there raising money for burn units and hospitals and doing good work and so forth. Now, is it your supposition, Freeman, that it's not possible to rise to the top, let's say, for example, in the music industry as an example? And we're coming up on a break here. We'll talk about this after. But is it not possible to rise to the top unless you become essentially a part of this OTO or become a Satanist? We'll get into that when we continue our conversation with Freeman Fly right here on The Conspiracy Show as we discuss the occult. Don't go away. Freeman Fly is with us as we discuss the occult. So my question before the break, Freeman, is it possible, and I'll just let you know this is a fairly short break and or a fairly short segment, and then we'll come back again after the next break. But is it possible to succeed in the music industry, to become a major recording artist, if you don't become essentially a Satanist?
There are layers to this, and by the time you're at the top, you're really within a satanic belief system, whether you are an official member or not. You're pretty much conditioned into it. But when you look at it, at the historical aspects of it, it's consistent as you watch who rises to the top. So Sammy Davis Jr. back in the day, he's a Satanist. As you start coming up, you got Led Zeppelin, members of the OTO. Jimmy Page even lived in Crowley's house on the Loch Ness. You looked at David Bowie, the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, and consistently on up through Tool. And you will see the aspects of this in music like Katy Perry's E.T., where she wants to make a supernatural baby be abducted by an alien and create. So this supernatural ET connection is also very strong within all of this storyline. It plays a heavy role in this. So you can see consistently who rises to the top are followers of this message.
Well, you mentioned alien abductions, and I was just trying to look up here very quickly, the author of a book about UFOs UFOs or rock stars that believed that they had been abducted by aliens, and the gentleman just passed away. I had him on my show several months ago.
Million Rock by Michael Luckman.
That's the gentleman. Yes,
Michael. I got it right here.
Michael Luckman just passed away, sadly, I mean, there are a number of prominent musicians. You know, John Lennon talked about having several close encounters, once when he was living at the Dakota, another one when he was in Greenwich Village living with May Pang. There was Ace Frehley, of course, of Kiss, Sammy Hagar, I believe Jerry Garcia, although, you know, when we're talking about the Grateful Dead and, of course, many of the substances that Mr. Garcia was ingesting, it's kind of hard to separate, you know, fact from fiction or a hallucinogenic episode or the real deal. What is the connection, do you think, between these alien abduction stories and some prominent rock stars?
Yeah, we've been looking heavily into that because, as you know, it's consistent there as well. And even I have my own alien abduction stories. So it's one that once we started to look deeper into the magical practices, we started to get into what's called the hidden God within the situation. We found that the whole situation was a matter of channeling extra-dimensional or extraterrestrial beings utilizing ritual magic. And so many of these people that we mentioned were also practitioners of this ritual magic. And we're finding that there is a real correlation that even when you look back to Aleister Crowley, when he was channeling an entity known as Lom, this was in the early 30s, that he was a gray. And no one had had a depiction of a gray yet, but Lom of Crowley, who he channeled, was. And this story keeps coming through the puzzle over and over again, that the elite are meeting in secret barns and channeling what they call the Nine, which are believed to be the Ennead, the Nine Gods of ancient Egypt, which also relate into this whole OTO situation. We just keep finding this a consistent theme. I really want the answer to that question, and you know, it could go as strange as, you know, this is one of the best ways to manipulate mankind.
Well, you know, I sort of share that view of the whole UFO ET phenomenon. That is, that we are not talking about intergalactic civilizations traveling to this planet. We're in fact talking about interdimensionals. And you know, as someone who, you know, a Bible believing a Christian, I believe in the unseen world. I believe in these other dimensions, and I think that's where they're coming from. They could be angelic or they could be demonic. So, is that what's happening here? That these abductions are about the invocation of these demonic entities as a means of controlling certain individuals? That's what the abduction phenomena is all about.
Well, this gets even stranger into our technological realms, because most of the time, like when we look to the Nazis and their ritual magic as they were channeling these entities, which they believed were inner Earth beings,
yes,
they were developing technology like the Bell Project that seemed to be able to open portals into the other dimension. So now we're moving into this new age. CERN will be moving to twice its maximum power in March. And when they launched CERN to world record levels, that was the day Barack Obama showed up at Norway to get his Nobel Peace Prize, and the Norway spiral opened in the sky.
Those strange lights,
all
yes.
These questions.
Interesting, yeah. I remember
okay,
that.
So I've done a deep research into that technology and have been really looking, because when you start to look into the occult, you find that it is at the heart of our technology. The television came to us through the Golden Dawn Society, another magical order that was also Crowley was a lead member in, but he moved on to the OTO. But the Golden Dawn gave us the Crookes tube, which became the cathode ray tube. And the first television broadcast was actually a Maltese cross that they attempted to send to the other side and receive a transmission back.
And now, Freeman, now our TVs, Samsung, this television, it's listening in on our conversation. Remember when that was sort of the sign of someone was, you know, considered a tinfoil hat wearing paranoid when they started talking about their TV was watching them? Well, now it's all coming true. Our TVs are watching us, and they're recording our voices and sending it to third parties. We have no knowledge of where that information is going.
Absolutely. I mean, when you sign into Skype for the first time, the instant message you receive is a quote from 1984 of Winston discussing whether Big Brother is real. So anyone that signs into Skype for the first time or you go to your original message, you'll see that they're sending you this message loud and clear. We have Google out buying artificial intelligence, quantum computers, and the Boston Dynamics military robots, right? So Google's working on becoming Skynet while they have a Calico system, their medical division, that is being used to create a massive DNA database.
And now, here we are on a Google Hangout. I guess we've sort of surrendered and at least to some extent become part of the Borg. Freeman, listen, stay with us. We're using their technology against them now, though. That's the big thing. We'll be back as we discuss the occult with Freeman Fly right here on The Conspiracy Show. Don't go away. And we are here with Freeman Fly, and I'm just going to check the hashtag TCS to see whether people are responding to that. And let's see. Someone here is JS at Jen Schmidt 1, using the hashtag TCS Freeman, talking about Phoenix, Arizona. Also, Phoenix, Arizona, and date all have symbolism. I heard recently, maybe it was one of the guests on the program, talking about Phoenix. Is it likewise set out as a Masonic symbol? What is the connection between Phoenix and Freemasonry? Phoenix, Arizona, yeah,
absolutely.
That is.
You know, I can almost open every Freemasonic book I have here, and you will see a Phoenix within it and the rising of this bird from the ashes. But what I found really curious, and we hadn't noticed this before, Manly P. Hall is one of the main authorities on Freemasonry, and he wrote a book called Secret Teachings of All Ages. And we were opening that during the Super Bowl ritual and realized that all aspects were represented in this Rosicrucian alchemical working, to the point that it had the phoenix, the lion, the goddess, and then a horned being, actually like a stag. And all of these symbols were represented in this magical practice of the Rosicrucians, which is yet another magical order in this situation.
And, of course, the Super Bowl taking place right there in Phoenix. Is there something about – I was trying to remember the degrees, latitude, and longitude where Phoenix is situated that is also significant?
I think it's in the 33rd or the 34th.
The 33rd degree.
Latitude.
I was trying to remember the book, and you mentioned Michael Luckman, who just passed, and that was Alien Rock, The Rock and Roll Extraterrestrial Connection. And as we were discussing that, you mentioned that you also had an abduction experience. Can you share that with me?
Yeah, it's a strange one, and I've had a few. See, now, my life is unusual. So my father was a worshipful master in Freemasonry and was on Killer Submarine with Jimmy Carter. He was chasing flying saucers in Project Blue Book, and by the time I was born, he was building nukes. So
wow,
my dad,
that's quite a lineage.
Yeah. And then my mother was raised by a renowned witch in France. She was saved by the Nazis from the Catholics and raised by a witch and brought up through the Eastern Star and was Esther within the Eastern Star. So this was my family that I didn't know any of this story at all. But at 10 years old, I drew an image that seems to outline galactic history, and it's blown my mind, and it has led my research for quite some time. You can see it on my website to see further. Just go to the Freeman Perspective television show. So what occurred is in 1993. Yeah, I was at Daytona Beach after graduating college, and it was spring break. And me and a friend went down to the beach. We sat down there, and this massive rectangle just seemed to be hanging out over the ocean. And it looked like a big rectangle with four subdivided squares. I've never seen anything like it. It kind of looked like a window into the other dimension. It was red and seemed translucent, although it had a strict ridge border. And my friend and I sat there staring at it for about 10 minutes with our jaws dropped and our fingers pointed. And I don't remember it leaving, but I remember watching my finger follow as it disappeared. Now, we jumped off that lifeguard stand and went back to the spring breakers where there were thousands of people, and everyone was gone. And we're freaking out. You know, we're thinking we're in some Twilight Zone episode. We're the only ones left on the planet. Everyone else is gone. It turned out that 5 hours had passed. It was now the middle of the night, and everyone had gone home. But it was 10 p.m. to us.
That's just textbook stuff, right? That time gap, textbook.
Yeah.
So,
and then I have another tale of seeing a giant V-shaped craft like what they saw in Phoenix, and then meeting the high priest of the Church of Satan right after that event. That was kind of a wild day.
Now, did you recapture these memories through a regression or any of that lost time? Did you learn what transpired during that last 5 hours?
I have not. I really did want to. And it really has been from that moment on that I've been able to project into the future and was able to predict that W would be forced into office, that there would be a major terrorist attack on 9/11, and that the next president would not be considered an American. And I have this all documented, and I was correct in every instance from this. And I kind of got the feeling that maybe I'd been shown have a plan, or, you know, I don't know. I would love to know. I would love to travel back and try and find out.
There's an interesting section on FreemanTV.com regarding the clones of Michael Jackson. Now, according to this theory, Michael Jackson was seeking immortality and perhaps was cloned. What can you tell me about that? Now, we've got about 7-8 minutes here, so...
Okay, this is a main agenda that has been really overshadowed by just people trying to make it ludicrous. So when human cloning became before Congress, they had Ra-El in his puffy white spacesuit speaking in behalf of human cloning. So, of course, everybody laughed it off. Uri Geller was a psychic, an Israeli psychic that they used to, he was the key bender. He was used in these rituals that I was discussing when they would channel the nine. And Uri Geller got together with Michael Jackson, and they began running around looking for immortality. Now, the first thing they thought was this mind transfer technology. And really, at this moment, CERN has the only computer capable of mind transfer technology. I'm not saying they're using it for that, but it's capable of it. You need to be able to push exabytes of information, which is tons and tons of information, to be able to transfer a mind. But so they looked into this first, and the roboticist is on film admitting that he had built this robot for Michael Jackson's skull. But I guess Michael decided he couldn't do his moonwalk in that robot and began looking deeper. So he and Uri Geller went and met with Ra-El. Now, Ra-El is an interesting character. He's a French journalist who met Yahweh in a flying saucer in the French Pyrenees, and then claimed to be the ambassador of the Elohim and is commissioned to build a embassy in Israel for the Elohim's return.
Oh, this is the Raelians. The Raelians. This is the Raelians, correct?
The Raelians, yes.
Right. So, but Michael Jackson, the idea here again was that he was going to sort of reese the attempt, and others are, you know, the whole, the human, transcendent movement.
Transhumanists,
thank you, are attempting to, you know, to find a way to you know, are seeking immortality, Ray Kurzweil and others. In fact, there was a movie made about it, Transcendence, with Johnny Depp. Was that the idea, that they were going to take Michael Jackson's consciousness and re-sleeve it in some sort of a robot?
Now, did I mention that Madonna has her own DNA cleanup crew? She paid
no.
people to go around and clean up her remnant DNA. That's
why?
Open news. You can go Google it for yourself. So they know something. I'll tell you that. They know something right off. But look at Michael Jackson's children. His children are transhumanist children. His blanket, nobody even knows who the parents are of blanket, because the mother that gave birth to it wasn't the egg, and the father is unknown. And his children are blonde-haired and blue-eyed, right? So Michael Jackson's kids are already this genetic experiment of a designer baby.
Wait a minute. I've seen pictures of them. They don't look blonde-haired and blue-eyed to me.
Oh, they absolutely are, especially Blanket. When Michael Jackson went to buy King Tut's replica of King Tut's golden sarcophagus,
right,
that he said that he was going to live forever, he has his children with them there, and they are blonde-haired, blue-eyed, especially if you his daughter, who's now coming out about all the Illuminati programming that she had to deal with, she's got piercing blue eyes. So are his children. They were all through surrogate mothers,
right,
and through genetic manipulation.
So do you think that there are some Michael Jackson clones out there already?
Well, there is a dentist attempting to clone John Lennon. He has his tooth. He bought it in an auction, and he plans on cloning John Lennon.
Yes.
Michael Jackson would have been cloned. If he could have done it, he would have. I have some theories that perhaps even time travel might be playing an instance in this situation. There was an unusual bust of Michael Jackson found from the period of Akhenaten, that is the 18th dynasty of ancient Egypt. It's identical to Michael Jackson. So I've wondered, because I've interviewed the head of the Time Travel Institute, and he told me this was a legitimate problem. And when Michael Jackson went out, when he was when he died, he was in debt to this Saudi Arabian prince. And this is the one place that the time travel experts say that they cannot control. I don't know. You know,
that does sound very bizarre. Is it not possible that Michael Jackson saw this bust and decided that he wanted to look like this bust?
No one noticed this bust until a month after Michael Jackson died. It had supposedly been in the Chicago Museum all this time, but no one had ever noticed.
Fascinating. So what is the...
Are you aware of my theories on Barack Obama? And do we have time to get into that?
We don't, unfortunately. We'll have to have you back on another program to talk about that. We've just got about 2.5 minutes here. What are you working on next? Is there another documentary in the works? I mean, you've produced hundreds of hours of documentaries.
I have produced a lot. I have 7 DVDs, 2 books, and a flash drive that are just jam-packed with information, each one hours and hours. I have a website filled with 10 years of backlog. But, yeah, I'm working on the Free Your Mind conference, getting ready for Free Your Mind 3, getting deeper and deeper into the occult and trying to express to people what the true purpose and methods of magic are.
That's coming up in Philadelphia, correct?
Yes, April 10th, 11th, and 12th in Philadelphia.
So we're like-minded, Freeman. You've got Free Your Mind, and I've got Follow the Truth, both coming up in April. And so, in the 1 minute here that we've got, just leave us with some positive news. I mean, how do we fight? This programmed reality, this prison planet that we're living in.
We are battling in a consciousness prison, and so it's subatomic. And realize that minimal effort will make maximum output. And so we are at a point where if we just start to change our mind about the situation that we're in, that we can literally change the planet. And this is what the occultists know and what these dark sorcerers are using against us. That's why they use so much effort to program our minds to fill their dreams and to fulfill their new world order, because we have the power to manifest. I have traveled this earth and wandered like Kung Fu and have met nothing but generous, loving, good, caring people all over the place. I have wandered for a decade before I came out on the air, and I'll tell you that the base core of humanity is loving, caring, generous beings that want nothing more than to be a part of this transition and to be a part of life. And if you open yourself to this situation by friendship and finding beauty, you'll find that the universe actually opens up and works in your favor, and there is a higher power guiding your life if you can find your true soul's purpose.
Do you believe that this is a consciousness-driven reality? In other words, it sounds like that's what you're saying, that consciousness creates matter, that we can essentially visualize this sort of alternative reality that you're proposing here to break out of this prison planet. Is that how it works, through consciousness?
The ancient magical axiom on that is the universe is mental, and that is at the heart of everything that we are seeing and all the actions that we're witnessing. And yeah, absolutely, the universe is mental.
Freeman, I appreciate your time tonight. Freeman Fly, it's the website is freemantv.com. Good meeting you. Thanks for hanging out.
Yeah, thank you so much. It was a good time.
All right, my thanks to Albert Vinzel and Tim Spreen for production. Back next week with Dr. John Hall and others, we'll talk about his brand new book, Guinea Pigs, Technologies of Control. You want to be here for that. And, of course, check out followthetruth.tv and get your tickets for the big conference coming up. Back next week, brand new show. Hope you'll be along for that. In the meantime, don't be afraid. There's nothing concealed that won't be revealed and nothing hidden that won't be made known. What you hear in the dark, speak in the light. What I say in a whisper, proclaim from the housetops. Move over, Aphrodite. I'm coming home. Good night.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.